Blog Talk Radio.
Sonic Effects. It's a pleasure to have you pulling up your seat and joining us today. Morning, afternoon, and evening, wherever you are in the face of the earth. Japan, hello. Russia, good day. And Greece and Zambia and Britain and Canada, United States. Lovely. Love to have you. It's a pleasure. We have a good program today, exhibiting understanding and transmission. You can tell. I think there's just so much discovery inside masonry, and I'm going to speak today a little more courageously than as if we need that, huh? But more. To explore some of the edges of our relationship. And I say this with all sincerity, we aren't what we were, but we may be in some ways better than we could have imagined. I'm inclined to think that to notice things, you know, like you do. We have this something, this je ne sais quoi, that has been exhibited in the world for hundreds of years, and the lovely part of the grand design was that we were doing things before we were fully aware of the extent of the reach of masonry. Nobody really could have calculated the way that masonry adapted to different cultures and different societies, but it has. If somebody had tried to calculate masonry, I think it would have failed miserably. But it had enough of the sense of the adventurer, because it was being of the adventure, it kept to guidelines. We've stayed away from dogma. Thus is the way that it is, and we've done that in spite of jowly old buggers. By keeping to the referring to masonry as a guide, it instinctively requires the power of the individual, the energy of the individual, in order to make it thrive. The principles of our order, this is exist, and here we we round up on the question of the tree that falls in the forest when nobody's around. Is there a sound? Well, are these things perception? Are they experience perception? Well, I tend to think in my old cluttered way that perception is the key. If we don't define it, it doesn't exist. This is coming from a point of view that all existence is in our mind, is impression. Everything is in vibrating, and I'm presuming here that I'm speaking to an audience aware of sort of a passing understanding of atomic and molecular and atomic and energy and what's been going on with the Hadron Collider. What information, the questions it's helping us to answer, and what information it's been producing. We are, in that sense, in motion. But in practical sense, do I look at you and as you're handing me my cup of tea, saying, oh, I cannot hold it because it's all, everything is in motion, and it might just flow through my fingers? Of course not. Instead, it's thank you. It's very nice of you, and no, I take it maybe with a little cream today, just because. You get my point. Depends on the mindset, doesn't it? How do we reconcile this? And I think, well, my goodness, a lofty question. How do we understand the connection? Just a few days ago, you know, I'm a plotter like some of you. I know some of you are just genius. You pick these ideas up and you run with them, and it's like I'm always impressed. Like, how do you do that? But I'm a plotter. I have to understand the medium before I can apply it. You know, I have to understand. It's like before I do that, it's just patches of color on a canvas. I have to understand the palette and the you know, how color, the complementarity, and how I can draw light in and out of certain colors and give shape to and dimension to a page. Yeah, I'm like that. I've had the one of those beautiful surprises where I've had a piece of somebody explain something to me in the most orderly and lovely manner that it was that knock on the head again, you know, the one that got it to our attention a long time ago. It's like that. We can find, we become what we live, you know. If we live a life of covetousness, that's what we become. If we live a life of suspicion, that's what we are. You and I may be playing on a stage for each other. That's what we are. I presume here, brethren, that we're not satisfied playing a role. We need to know what and who we are authentically. And we begin asking questions, and we temper those questions with this notion of truth. We need to know the truth about ourselves. Not that we're going to share it with anybody else, because, my Lord, how do we share it if we don't know it? So I'm telling you what I think you want to hear, or what is going to give me some advantage in the moment, always with this notion of privacy. I'm not quite sure I can let the world pour in and see what I see. We are in various degrees men of privacy. In fact, when somebody tells me that they're an open book, it often raises an eyebrow. And that's what they're portraying. My observations are quite different about open books. People's behavior You know, behavior demonstrates so much of the truth of what's motivating individuals. And really, it's very, very hard to disguise that. And if you do, if you're working on that level, I don't know if I want to be around you, you know. Unless we're sitting at a chessboard and there you're showing me this strategic thinking. Thank you very much. I just love the idea of the board. The game, I'm terrible at it, but I just love the idea of the board. It's like listening to a song for me. And each time these notes come together in different configurations. And the chess masters create these symphonies, these layered cascades of tone and volume. Exquisite. The message is that seemed to really felt very, very affirming was about finding connections and finding the beauty of those connections, noticing them, searching for them, asking those questions. It's quite wonderful once you figure that out, that if we're going to be studying esoteric material, do we study it for the sake of accumulation of the information, or are we studying for the sake of applying that information to our reasoning and to our thinking in general? And in a sense, we begin by knowing who in the world we are. Tedious, I know. If I'm sitting down, coming into a party, this is a good way to dampen the atmosphere. Unless this is spontaneously pops up. It's that spontaneity that's so delightful. It's just there. We need to know how. But we don't have this conversation 24/7. Oh my goodness, I would be running down the street to avoid you, ducking behind the tree to avoid you. I just don't want to have this conversation all the time. Well, you know, there's times. I'm in a place for everything. But reasoning and truth, that's where we need gentility, we're taught. We need some level of civility to allow us to be pushed and to push. It's a fact that when we start with an idea, we have more information behind that idea that comes to the fore when we need it. And we can construct atmospheres in which we allow each other to push without feeling threatened or defeated. The energy the effort is to bring the energy to the surface, to find the more profound ideas, the clarity, with that feeling that if we start with a shadow of reason, by in dialogue back and forth, passing the idea, building the idea back and forth, pushing, questioning, probing, we begin to understand our own thinking better than we did when we began. Participants do. There's without apology to the outside world. There's the world of clutter and rashness and emotional thinking. It's not going to change. It plagues us in so many ways. And yet, knowing that doesn't stop it, does it? you can understand how an order based on reason and self-awareness would feel threatened in 2023, in a way, unless you're mature, and I think mature is the right word, mature enough to realize that we aren't out to change the world globally. We're not that kind of force. But we're unyielding that we do what we think is best, whether it's in terms of our faith or in terms of our politics. Those are, you know, we're tipping into spiritual existence, aren't we? Oh, very important that we don't give up all sense. This is not, you know, sitting cross-legged in a airport handing out Joss sticks. No, it's not like that. There's an air of certainty that brings a responsibility. Once we describe it, we can run around and think, oh, my goodness, everybody should know, you know, because I know and, you know, who am I? Everybody should know this. And we make a lot of wrong assumptions. But what happens then? What happens then? Do we, and that's what we're faced with now. Over time, there are things affecting the premise, the landmarks of masonry, the perspective on ancient landmarks that you and I do not control. I'll underline that and say that the denominator for that is relevance. Now, if I don't know the general theory of relativity, let's pick something that just makes me crazy most of the time. Does it mean that it doesn't exist? Well, come on. If I read a page or listen to a presentation, does it mean that I understand? Not necessarily. It means that I am taking it. I have an interest. Similar. Masonry, do I understand it? There are moments when I feel that I have a toehold. And then a reality sets in and I realize, to my delight, honestly, there is so much more to learn. I want to read your work. I want to listen to your lecture. I want to sit in lodge with you. I want to absorb your thinking about the craft, the way that you experience it, how you savor the moments. I'll admit that I'm a sucker for somewhere along that line between a sophisticated conversation and just a group being with a group that absolutely enjoys the experience of brotherhood. One day I hope I'll be in a lodge where all those things come together. And I do. I hope I have that experience again. It's wonderful when that happens. And somewhere in the question is following us in our wisdom and hindsight. Where is the relevance? Well, we know it's not with our bureaucracies. Thank goodness our bureaucracies are there because they help the continuation of our accountability. The elements of masonry that are necessary for our preservation, the preservation of our constitutional authority. The other side, this whole notion of moral authority, that's you and us where we open up our minds, yeah? And when I, if I was to ask you to think about the places or the experiences where there is an enrichment of our an excitation around our spiritual awareness, where would you say that is? Is it a place? Is it a Zen garden? Or we go to this atmosphere. You know, the signpost, it doesn't say sit over there and observe here, and this moment of enlightenment may occur. It's sit there and you wonder and you ponder and you contemplate. Yeah, the beauty of that garden is that it's impressionistic. Today, exhibiting understanding and transmission, I was looking at different phases, thinking about different phases of thinking, what we do with the ideas of masonry as an entity. And then I continued that on with the work of, I think I have this feeling that we've visited Gerald Manley Hopkins' work in the not too distant past. His poem Windhover is I think a nice compliment to the storyline today. Beautiful bird that flies in one spot, just hovers. So if we've done our work here with to your satisfaction, the music, the atmosphere that you're in, then we'll connect and you can help me answer these questions. Do you mind? Here, I'd like to offer some music to help add to the occasion, if you don't mind. Bill Evans, this is I picked this today because it's my brother's name is Gary, lovely man. Yeah, Gary's theme. You are all, my brother. We use other words today. Alchemy branched out into chemistry and psychology, natural philosophy, and then philosophy with a dash of science and belief. Today, men approach the order of Freemasonry as an elliptical spectrums of understanding on steroids. Understanding isn't a competition. It is nice to quote ritual, but it is not a reflection of understanding the ideas it contains. Reciting doesn't mean we understand. Efforts to educate brethren have great variations. In my location, for instance, the first consistent impression is desperation. Learning is codified into a motivation of success and compliance. Compliance with what? To do this, a connection with psyche and the individual deeper meaning has to be ignored. The way to do that is not fully understood. One way is to make philosophical injunctions seem elitist. This is a crude idea, I agree. It ignores the actual humble context of Greek thinkers. Saying that philosophy is elitist doesn't really fit. The aesthete, Diogenes, lived in a barrel. Socrates ignored popularity, dressed in simple, threadbare robes. He held court in public with students joining as they felt. Plato told us, "I know that I know nothing." Without hubris, emphasis was on the heart and mind of the willing student of life, a man who wanted to know if he was a moral creature, if his principles of life were truth or illusion. And so they asked uncomfortable questions, and for that they were condemned as being overbearing and dangerous. Masonry guides us into inner wisdom to look for what is good in another man, encouraging such positivity with an influence that counteracts mistrust. To do that, we need first to do it within ourselves, to know. To know, I think, is to respect. The real world teaches division, competition, and mistrust. Put real world in quotations. Men do not drop their guard easily. They need to feel the consistency and benefit of understanding by receiving it from us. Can you and I access this knowledge? There is one way to know. Today's message has been unpopularly beneficial for thousands of years. It will be there for us when we knock. When I am straight with the world, then maybe I can expect that of others. Until then, time tells all, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
That'll just have to do. Gerald Manley Hopkins was born in 1844. Influential. Interesting, interesting. He was an English poet and Jesuit priest. One of the most individual of Victorian writers, according to the website Britannica. Hopkins was the eldest of nine children of Manley Hopkins, who's an Anglican, who had been the British Consul General in Hawaii, and himself had published poetry. Now, when he was a little boy in Highgate Grammar School, Hopkins won a poetry prize. In 1863, he was awarded a grant to study at Beloit College, one of the colleges of Oxford University, where he continued writing poetry while studying classics. And 3 years later, 1866, in the prevailing atmosphere of the Oxford movement, he was part of that. And that was where there was an interest, an intellectualized interest in the relationships between Anglicanism and Roman Catholicism. And those of you who have an inkling of these two forms will have a sense of the importance of that. He was received into the Roman Catholic Church by John Henry, who later Cardinal Newman. The following year, he left Oxford with such a distinguished academic record that Benjamin Jowett, then the Beloit lecturer and later master of the college, called him the Star of Beloit. Hopkins decided to become a priest when he entered the Jesuit novitiate in 1868. And then he decided, he burned all his poetry and determined it's not right to write no more belonging to this profession. And until 1875, he kept a journal recording his vivid responses to nature, his expression of philosophy. And he later found great support in Duns Scotus, the medieval Franciscan thinker. Now, Hopkins' philosophy emphasized the individuality of every natural thing, which he called inscape. To Hopkins, each sensuous impression had its own elusive selfness, and scene was to him a sweet, especial scene. That's the kind of person that we're looking at. He went to Dublin, and he developed a musical composition. He composed, and then he began drawing. And he died of typhoid fever. He was buried in Glasnevin Cemetery in Dublin, along with a pile of his unfinished works. It was after his death, Robert Bridges began to publish a few of the most mature poems and anthologies, hoping to prepare the way for wider acceptance of Hopkins' style. By 1918, Bridges, then the poet laureate, judged the time opportune for the first collected edition. And apparently it's sold slowly. Not until 1930 that a second edition was issued, and then Hopkins' work began to be recognized as amongst the most original, powerful, and influential literary accomplishments of his century. That had a marked influence on such 20th century poets as T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, W.H. Auden, Stephen Spender, and C. Day Lewis. Here, this is Wendover. I'll just give you a taste in the analysis of this poem, and then you give you some framework as you listen to it. Okay. This is The Windover is a bird with a rare ability to hover in the air. It seems like it's flying in place while it scans the ground looking for its next meal. And in this poem, the poet describes how he saw or caught one of these birds in the midst of hovering. Its motion's controlled and suspended, and he's noticing this and the energy. Now, the form of this poem is a sonnet, but it has a confusing grammatical structure. So prepare yourself. The Windover follows the pattern of so many of Hopkins' sonnets. Sensuous experience, taking it in from through his senses, and it leads to a set of moral reflections. Just like what happens when you and I are inspired by a piece of music or a poem or something that we see as we're walking along the street or through the forest. At line 9, the poem shifts into the present tense, away from the recollection of the bird. The horse and rider metaphor. Hopkins is depicting the Windover's motion. The image of the great architect on horseback. Here. I caught this morning's kingdom of daylight's dauphin, dappled on drawn falcon in his riding. Of the rolling level underneath him, steady air and striding high there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off forth on swing. As a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurl and gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart in hiding stirred for a bird, the achieve of the mastery of the thing. Brute beauty and valor and act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle. And the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times told lovelier, more dangerous, oh, my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plow down sillion shine and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear. Fall gall of zelf and gash gold's vermilion. Thank you. Lou Donaldson. Autumn Nocturne. Yeah, no. Northern Hemisphere are facing autumn. And our friends in the Southern Hemisphere are facing spring. Welcome. Embrace it. Eh? Here, this first, here, the History Corner. And we're working, we've been working our way through, and now we're in the 1780s. And this portion of the history opens with a statement that I've not heard before, but I've been searching for the meaning to understand this. Here, you help me with this. And this is our lodge in The Hague and the circumstance. And we're going to see a left turn happening here. In this passage. So, you know, we're looking at influence of Britain on Amsterdam and The Hague, masonry and different political structure, different upheavals. The Masonic Order, the brothers are reminded, originated in the superstitious centuries and was then transmitted to our better enlightened times. Still has a ring, doesn't it? Every effort is made to be joyful. A general hospitality pervades the meeting, and we are told that the master is filled with patriotic, disinterested, and freedom-loving feelings, even in this time of unrelenting attack. Lustful oppressions and the violation of the most holy alliances of our neighbors. Although vague as recorded, the remarks tell us that the events of the moment pervaded the proceedings. In this instance, the lodge was hailed as a refuge from the world, a place of friendship and hospitality. At the next meeting, concerns about the political and economic situation in the Republic becomes more explicit. Welfare of the people is at its greatest low. Then there is a discussion of the three known forms of government, without a preference expressed in the minutes. Did some brothers favor monarchy or aristocracy or democracy? Perhaps there were voices raised for all three. At the very next meeting in 1782, a proposal comes from the Grand Lodge of The Hague to conclude in alliance with the freedom-loving and now independent lodges of the Great East of North America. In these troubled times, the Dutch had supported the American colonies against their commercial rival across the channel. Critics of the Stadtholder had been particularly avid for the American cause, for which loans were raised in patriotic circles in Amsterdam. Also in 1782, a treaty was concluded between the two nations. In concluding the Masonic alliance with the American brothers, our Amsterdam Lodge was now open to American visitors. Within a few months, a brother arrives from a lodge in Pennsylvania to effect this alliance and correspondence with the Free Brothers of North America. The visitors from America arrived at a good moment amidst discussions that were going on in the lodge about the nature of government, about the best form it should take. If men were discussing the forms of a known government and deeply distressed about the condition of the people, they might have much to learn from discussions with Americans recently successful in their search for freedom and independence. And with that success in Pennsylvania had come a major expansion of Freemasonry in the new state. In 1778, the Grand Lodge of Pennsylvania had made a firm commitment to the revolutionary cause. Historians of Dutch and Anglo-American republicanism are beginning to recognize that despite their different languages, Dutch and American republicans share a conceptual universe that decried tyranny and decadence of entrenched interests. And they looked to the Romans and to the more recent republicans of the 17th and 18th centuries for guidance. Conversations such as the ones that went on in La Bien-Aimée may have facilitated the forging of a transatlantic republican consciousness. What the Pennsylvania brother saw must have been impressive. As your thoughts thread their way through that piece of history, I imagine it's interesting to reflect on what's going on around us. Still, hundreds of years later, we have these questions about democracy and the rights of people and the condition of average citizen. It's a struggle. That seems to be ongoing. And yet, here we sit, offering place of reprieve, a sanctuary, where we sit, men set aside those differences and think about the grander and bigger and more important picture, what brings us together, as much as we examine what separates. We're part of that landscape. And we know, we must know, if we look for it, as we look for it, that there are men just like us, every culture, every place in the world. Not total. Nobody's walking around. The uniformity? No. People will act, be as compliant as necessary to remain safe. It's always been that way. But within that fabric, we know there are individuals capable of their own thoughts. So when we're in Lodge, and I hope you will join me one day, will be to be our pleasure to inspire you, to give you, to bring for you the dignity that Masonry requires and expects and what you deserve, so that you can sit back and take it in. And then hopefully we'll recharge. Next week, though, the commentary will be absolutely scintillating. In the meantime, there's a lot going on. And it's no better time for an engaging, intelligent mind to be alive. This is just remarkable. So find your favorite music, find your favorite company, or a moment of tranquility, whether it's in that crowded room or meeting or on the promenade or in the street, where you can just sit and reflect to the sounds and the light and the movement around you. Just know that you're certainly not alone. Commit those acts of random Masonic kindness. And then be sure to include yourself. Bye for now.